Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom aleichem, assalamu aleichem, namaste, pak sadnam, sat sri akal, tashi dalek, ho lila tanya wase yake. Hello, may everything be well with you as it is with me. Let me check our recording levels here, make sure, okay, everything looks fine. So we'll get on with this lesson. Before we start the lesson, I'm going to recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you are close who has passed away, who has passed over. And in doing so, you'll honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your own consciousness. Yiskadal v'yishkadash me'rabo, bomo dive ro kirase, ve'yamlik melkase v'kayakon uvyu mekon, uvkaye dekol beis Yisrael, ba'agalo uvizman koryev ve'imru omen. Yehe shmei rabo mavorak le'olam ule'olme omayo. Yisbarak v'yisdavak v'yisbarar v'yisvermam v'yisnase v'yishadar v'yishale v'yishalal sh'medukadjo berakhu le'elo minko berkaso v'shoroso tushbekoso v'kenos v'nekamoso da'amiron be'olmo v'yimru omen. Yehe shlomo rabo min shamayo v'kayim alenu ve'al kol Yisrael v'yimru omen. O say shalom bimramav, hu yashe shalom, aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael ve'imru, amen. Thank you very much. Well, I know in our last meeting I said that that had wrapped up the teachings that I wanted to present on Merkaba mysticism, but I find that I have one more, which will be today. And that is, I wanted to talk about the fact that Merkaba mysticism is the most ancient form of mysticism that we're really, Jewish mysticism that we're really familiar with, and that it's the longest lasting. And I'd said before that it lasted about 1,000 years. And that's true, that it did. And I'd even pointed out that there are elements of Merkaba mysticism that are still a part of Kabbalah today. And having said all of that, what I want to do is make sure that I didn't give the impression that it didn't have a beginning, a middle, and then a peak that it reached, after which it declined to an ending point. So although that ending point is real fuzzy, and we can say that it may never have really ended, that there may indeed be groups of Merkaba mystics today, it is more accurate to say, and I don't want you to think that I was leading you astray or didn't know what I was talking about, but I could see how what I said could leave one with a mistaken understanding, and that is that it never had a peak and never really declined, because it did. And its peak was around the 5th century CE, and it was really strong between the 1st century before the Common Era and kept gaining in strength all the way to about the 3rd century of the Common Era, and then peaked out and then began to decline, a long, slow decline after the 5th century of the Common Era. So I wanted to talk a little bit about three things: the succession of or cycle of teachers and students for the Merkaba, who they were, and how they involved the great rabbis of the time. See, and the reason I want to point this out is because today it is very common for there to be a divide between the rabbinate, the rabbis in Judaism, and the mystics. And that never used to be the case. The rabbis were the mystics. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Then I wanted to talk about what led to the decline of Merkaba mysticism, beginning after the 5th century CE. And that involves giving you some examples of the methods used in Merkaba mysticism, straight out of the writings left behind by Rabbi Ishmael of the time of the in the first century, who was lived in the time of the when the Second Temple was both there and then destroyed. Okay, so that's what we're going to do today, and then we should be finished with Merkaba mysticism, and we'll begin the survey of early Kabbalah on Wednesday. All right, first thing I wanted to talk about, early masters and disciples of the chariot, of the Merkaba. And so here's the information that I want to get out. We start out with Rabbi Nehunia ben Hakane. He lived in the first century of the Common Era. He was considered to be the greatest esoteric master of his time. He passed on his knowledge of mysticism to his greatest disciple, who is Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha. Now, this is the Rabbi Ishmael I just mentioned previously, of whom I'm going to be reading some accounts that he left behind of his mystical experiences. And so Rabbi Nehemiah passed on the tradition of Merkaba mysticism to his disciples, among whom the greatest was Rabbi Ishmael. And he was, in his time, and like I say, he lived in the first century Common Era, and he was the high priest, Kohen Gadol, the high priest, in the last days of the Second Temple. So this was no small fry among the rabbis. He was a Kohen, a hereditary descendant from Aaron, Moses' brother. And he was a mystic, because he learned his mysticism, his Merkaba mysticism, the use of the divine names, and the meditations, from Rabbi Nehemiah before him. Okay, then we go ahead. This was in around in the first century. Go up into the second century, and we find Rabbi Judah the Prince. He lived between 120 and 189 Common Era. He was a mystic, a Merkaba mystic, and he was also the redactor of the Mishnah. Now, what do I mean when I say he was the redactor of the... Now, first of all, what's the Mishnah? The Mishnah are the oral teachings on the written Torah handed down at Sinai to Moses from God. So the Mishnah are the literal teachings that expand upon these were the oral teachings that expand upon the written teachings in the first five books of what we call the Bible now, which is the Torah proper. Okay, and Rabbi Judah the Prince was the redactor of the Mishnah. Now remember, at this time, the oral Torah at that time had been passed down orally, teacher to student, and was not written down. But now it was, from here on out, beginning with Rabbi Judah the Prince, in the second century, early in the second century of Common Era, it began to be written down. Now, why is this? Because the sages got together and said, you know, we've been through a lot of persecutions by the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, others, but now these Romans are something else. And they've been afflicting us for a long time, but they are oppressing us so hard, so severely, that it's entirely possible that they'll kill enough of the rabbis and enough of the sages that the oral Torah will die out, will be incapable of preserving it. and passing it down. So we're going to have to write it down. And we will write it down and we will keep it secret from everyone except those who, the sages who are going to pass it down. Okay. So we have Rabbi Judah the prince, who was the first. Okay, and this is what the what it means by a redactor. He was the first one who started setting down the oral Torah in writing. Now, a redactor is different than an author. An author is a person who is the originator of a book or an article, the creator, the originator. Whereas a redactor is not the creator or originator. The redactor is the person who takes that which has already been originated and created and prepares it, gets it ready for publication. So that's what we mean when we say that somebody was a redactor of the Mishnah. That means he didn't make it up. He wasn't the creator or the originator. He was the person who wrote it down and who edited it and revised it. Well, not revised, but got it into the right order for presentation in a publication, to have it passed around in written form to other people, so that it could be passed on in written form instead of just orally. All right. And of course, the reason for this, as I said earlier, is because they were afraid that if it wasn't in a written form, which could be then hidden, be made into several copies and hidden away, that they could kill off and this is conceivable, their opponents, the Romans and others, could kill the last Jewish rabbi who knew the Oral Torah. And then it would be lost. With that person's death, the Oral Torah would be lost forever. But in writing it down and having it in a number of copies, you can hide those away somewhere. And it doesn't matter if they killed the last Jew who knew it orally, because it's hidden away and it's in writing, so it can be retrieved. All right. Okay. The greatest disciple of Rabbi Judah the prince was Rabbi Yochanan. He died around the year 279 CE. He was the redactor of the Jerusalem Talmud. Now, see, there were two Talmuds. There was one in Babylon, called the Babylonian Talmud, and then there was another one called the Jerusalem Talmud. There were some differences in them. Rabbi Yochanan was considered to be the greatest rabbi of his time in Palestine. And then his student was Rabbi Asi, S like in Sam, S like in Sam, I. And he lived in the third in that period between the 3rd and 4th centuries CE. He was a great Talmudist. All of these were skilled. All of these rabbis I'm talking about were, and you can see two things that they were. On the outside, exoterically, they were redactors of the Mishnah, redactors of the Jerusalem Talmud, the high priest of the Second Temple, in the last days of the Second Temple, and Rabbi Asi was a great Talmudist. So these were things that were exoteric, but esoterically, they were also mystics, great mystics. And they carried on the Merkabah tradition. Okay, then finally we come to Rav Yosef and Rav Zaira. These were great rabbis of the 3rd and 4th centuries Common Era, and they were versed also in the mysteries of the Merkabah. Now this brings us up to the 5th century Common Era, after which the work of the Merkabah began to decline as the major stream of Jewish mysticism. Now why would there be a decline? And why would it begin after the 5th century Common Era? Well, there's a number of reasons, but the two ones that I'm going to talk about are major reasons. And it is this. It is, and this is not just my opinion. I'm going to read passages that will back this up, that will give evidence of this. of this conclusion that I've drawn, is that it was just too dangerous, a methodology of mysticism to engage in, and the results were just too questionable as to their validity. Now, the method that was used, that I'm talking about, that was dangerous and resulted in questionable results, involved acts of bodily mortification, or generally called asceticism. You know, you're fasting and things of this nature. You withdraw from conversation with people or any kind of interaction, and you shut yourself away and have no dealings with other people, and you don't eat and you fast, and then purification, the second part, and this is going to the mikveh, the lake or stream in which you bathe yourself and purify yourself as you say prayers and blessings. And then the method of when you, this is what prepares you, and then when you actually go as a mystic, when you actually ascend on the chariot, it involves the passing of the gatekeeper angels that I've talked about in the last several teachings. And the way you get past them is you bind those gatekeeping angels to do your will, which is to open the gates of righteousness to let you enter into the next higher chamber. And you do this through the use of divine names. When you know the names of God, you can recite those names, and those names apply to certain levels, to certain of those seven divine heavens, and within which there are seven chambers within each other. And each one of those 49, and we can call these whole thing, refer to these heavens, to these chambers within heavens as levels. Levels of consciousness to which the mystic either descends or ascends, however you want to look at it, does not really make that much of a difference. That these gatekeeping angels are controlled by divine names that apply only to the level at which those gatekeeping angels are assigned. And once those divine names are recited, then those angels are bound by the power of those names, which is being used by the mystic. All right, then. Now, I just said, though, that these methods became too dangerous and the results too questionable after the year, after the turn of the 5th century, after the 5th century was over, sometime in the 5th century. Now, why would that be that it's not the case before then, but it was the case after then? Because the method of purification involved purification with the ashes of the red heifer. Now, the red heifer is a special sacrifice that was discussed, is laid out in detail in the book of Numbers, in the Torah, in the book of Numbers, chapter 19. And I'm not going to get into it except to say that a special heifer, red in color, without blemish, is selected from the herds of all Israel for this special sacrifice. And then it's sacrificed in a special way, and its ashes are obtained after it's burned. And then these ashes are used for a super powerful or potent purification. However, the red heifer had to be sacrificed on the altar of the temple. So therefore, you could only obtain ashes from the red heifer, no matter who you were, no matter how high in the hierarchy of rabbis you were, even if you were the Kohen Gadol, the great or chief of all rabbis, you could not obtain the ashes unless they had been made through the sacrifice through this special ritual in Numbers 19 on the altar of the temple. So in the year 70 CE, when the Second Temple was destroyed, there could no longer be a sacrifice of the red heifer, because the temple in which it was sacrificed and the altar in which it was burned was destroyed. So you could go out and get another heifer and you could burn it on another altar, but it doesn't comply with the requirements set forth in Numbers 19. Therefore, it does not have the high sanctity, the high level of holiness. It does not have the purification powers of the ashes derived from the sacrifice of the red heifer in accordance with Numbers chapter 19 on the altar within the temple when it existed. So after the temple was destroyed, whatever ashes were left was it. It was now a limited quantity. They could never be added to. Those ashes lasted until the 5th century. And I find this just fascinating. They hung on to these ashes and they parceled them out when needed for prophecy and vision. When they needed prophecies and visions. And when those ran out in the 5th century, this would be, in the time of Malachi, Jeremiah, who else? Well, that's all that comes to my mind right now, but these are the last of the prophets. This is why it was said and taught that the age of prophecy ended, came to an end, a conclusion, after the 5th century. There were no more prophets because, and there were no more valid visions because there were no more ashes of the red heifer. No more could be made because the temple and altar in which they had the only place and only way they could be made was gone. And those which had remained had finally been used up. So the age of prophecy and vision on the level of prophecy ended after the 5th century CE. And the only types of vision or prophecy, and this would not be true prophecy, but the only types of vision, let me put it that way, that a mystic could obtain would be granted as a result of the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, which still exists today, of course. And we're all capable of experiencing Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Wind, the Holy Spirit. But that's at a much lower level than the level of true prophecy, as is taught to us by in the writings and teachings of Rabbi Chaim Vital, and in the writings of Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lozado later. All right, so that's the reason that Merkabah mysticism began to decline, because the whole purpose was to ascend to these high levels and obtain this vision. And you could not do this if you did not have, if you had not purified yourself using the ashes of the red heifer. All right. Now, I told you that I would read to you some passages. And the first three passages I'm going to read they illustrate the techniques and the visions of the Merkabah mystics. And these are passages that are written or taken from the accounts of Rabbi Ishmael. This is the rabbi who lived in the last days of the Second Temple. He was the high priest, the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest at the time. But he was, as I say, a Merkabah mystic. And I'm going to read to you three passages. The first one comes from the Talmud, Berakot 7a. It's fairly short. Rabbi Ishmael is reported to have said, I once entered the innermost chamber of the Holy of Holies to burn incense on Yom Kippur. I saw Akteriel Yah, the Lord of hosts, sitting on a high and exalted throne. He said to me, Ishmael, my son, bless me. I replied, May it be your will that you withhold your anger and let your mercy be revealed over your attributes. May you deal with your children with the attributes of mercy and enter with them beyond the call of the law. He then nodded his head. And that's that passage. And I wanted to comment on this. What he says here is he's reporting a vision that occurred when he was involved in Merkaba mysticism in his meditation. And he says that he entered one of the innermost chamber to burn incense. Now, he was the high priest. He was the only one authorized to go into there. So he went into the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber, there to burn incense as commanded in the written Torah. And he says that when he went in there, he experienced this vision. And what he saw was Akhtariel Yah. Now, Akhtariel is a name of an angel. Of an angel who is providing the voice for Yah. Yah is one of the divine names of God. So he's not claiming that he saw God, the Lord of hosts, sitting on a high and exalted throne. Who he's saying he saw was Akhtariel, one of the archangels, one of the voices and visions through which Yah speaks. Because remember, if he saw God himself, anybody who sees God himself cannot see God and live. Remember, we're taught that in Exodus. All right, so he saw Akhtariel Yah, the Lord of hosts, sitting on a high and exalted throne. And this angel said, Ishmael, my son, bless me. Now, the angel is just a mouthpiece. So who's speaking here is God through this angel. And so then Rabbi Ishmael replies, May it be your will that you withhold your anger and let your mercy be revealed over your attributes. Well, the God of Merkaba mysticism is God in his aspect of king. And he is a God of fear and dominion, or I should say dominion and fear. And the two highest angels who sit on his right and left hands are the angels of dominion. That means that God has dominion over all. And on the other side is fear. The all can only regard God with fear. And so here it is that Rabbi Ishmael says, May it be your will that you withhold your anger and let your mercy be revealed over your attributes. So he's saying, please withhold your anger and allow your mercy, your attribute of mercy, chesed, to reign or be revealed in a superior way over your other attributes, over your judgment, for example. Because if we were all judged, we would all be killed immediately if we were judged according to our merits. So he's saying, please don't judge me by your merits. Please withhold your anger and let your mercy have dominion over your other attributes. So it's a roundabout way of saying, have mercy upon me and don't kill me. And then he says, may you deal with your children with the attribute of mercy and enter with them beyond the call of the law. And now he's asking for the same dispensation for, he says, your children. Well, who he's referring to is the children of Israel. He's the high priest. That's his function, is to be the intercessor, just as Moses was on Sinai many times and in the wanderings through the desert for 40 years, where he interceded on behalf of the children of Israel before God, Yahweh, to keep that God who was angry with them and said, I've had it with this obstinate people, this stiff-necked people. I'm going to destroy them and start over. And Moses interceded and said, please don't do that. Well, that's what the high priest is doing here. He's taken the place of Moses, and he's asking God to reign over them with his attribute of mercy and enter with them beyond the call of the law. What does that mean? Well, if God were to deal with his children of Israel according to the law, that's laid out for us in the Torah, then they would all be judged wanting and would be destroyed. And he's saying, please exercise mercy with your children of Israel and deal with them beyond the call of law. Well, that means instead of the call of the law, that means with the call of the Spirit. And then it says here, he, referring to this angel, Akteriel Yah, speaking and appearing on behalf of the Holy One, blessed be he, then nodded his head. All right. The second passage that I want to go into, also by Rabbi Ishmael. This comes from a midrash taken from Sefer HaPardes, which means Book of the Orchards. I get a little drink here for my throat of some coffee. Rabbi Ishmael said, I was 13 years old when I went to study with Rabbi Nehunaya ben Hakanah. I asked him, who is the prince of the Torah? And he replied, his name is Yofiel. I was already fasting, but I decided to increase my mortification. I separated myself from all enjoyment for an additional 40 days beyond my previous fasts. At the end of the 40 days, I pronounced the great name and brought down the angel Yofiel. He descended in a flaming fire, and his face was like a flash of lightning. When I saw him, I trembled and was confounded. My limbs seemed to dismember themselves, and I fell over backward. He said to me, Son of man, how dare you agitate the great assembly on high? I fortified myself and replied, it is known and revealed before the one who spoke and brought the world into being that I did not bring you down to earth for my own honor, but only to do the will of your master. He immediately said to me, Son of man, you putrid drop, you worm, you maggot, even if your soul has begun to purify itself, you are still attached to a defiled body. If you wish that I reveal myself to you, fast for 40 days and immerse yourself 24 times each day. Do not taste anything that causes an odor, nor eat any kind of beans or vegetables. Sit in a dark room and do not look at any woman. After I had done this, he taught me a divine name with which I would ascend and descend. That's a midrash taken from Sefer HaPardes, Book of the Orchards. Now, what's striking about this, or it should be, it is to me, and it should be to you, is the great power that one tempts when one is a mystic and ascends to the higher levels of being, to the higher divine worlds, to the chambers within those divine worlds, where there are these gatekeeping angels. Right off the bat here in this midrash, Rabbi Ishmael says that he was 13 years old when he went to study with Rabbi Nehunaya. And that's when he asked him, who is the prince of the Torah? And he said, and he's asking basically, who is the angel in charge of the Torah? He says, his name is Yofiel. So Rabbi Nehunaya told Rabbi Ishmael when he was only 13 that the name of the angel who is the minister of the Torah is Yofiel. And of course, the last part of that name is El, which means God. Okay, so it means something of God, Yof of God. And he says that he had already been fasting, but decided to increase his mortification. So he spent an additional 40 days beyond his previous fasts. And at that time, he pronounced the great name and brought down the angel Yofiel. Now, we're not told what that great name is, but it's a name that's known to him and to his teacher, Rabbi Nehunaya. And he pronounces that name. And when he pronounces the name, what does it do? It causes the angel Yofiel to be brought down. That means to appear in front of Rabbi Ishmael. And this great angel, Yofiel, descends in a flaming fire, and his face was like a flash of lightning. And it's so terrifying that he says, when I saw him, I trembled and was confounded. My limbs seemed to dismember themselves, and I fell over backwards. That means that he grew so weak that he collapsed. And this angel said, "Son of man, how dare you agitate the great assembly on high?" That's a reference to the angels and to the archangels, the choir of angels, to the ministering angels, and to the sages who have passed away before and have been gathered into the quote-unquote great academy and the great assembly where they study Torah. So he gathered his strength, and he says, you need to know, I'm going to just paraphrase this, I didn't call you for my own honor. I only called you down to do the will of your master, who would be the one who brought this world into being. And then this angel says, son of man, you putrid drop, you worm, you maggot, even if your soul has begun, meaning to purify itself, you're still attached to a defiled body. In other words, he was unsuccessful in getting his soul to leave his body entirely. And really what we could glean from this here is that this angel would be then capable of killing Rabbi Ishmael right on the spot. And he has great anger at the impudence, at the arrogance of this 13-year-old boy to call him down. But obviously, and he could kill him, but he doesn't, because obviously he knows some things. He was able to recite the great name that invoked him, that caused that angel to come down. So he says, all right, if you wish that I reveal myself to you, here's what additionally you must do. You must fast for another 40 days, that would make 80, and immerse yourself 24 times each day. He's got to purify himself 20, that's every hour, once an hour, for those 40 days. So once an hour, 24 times a day for 40 days, he's got to go into the mikveh, recite the blessings and prayers. And he says, do not taste anything that causes an odor, nor eat any kind of beans or vegetables, which there's some impurities in them, and they're going to cause the creation of odors in the body. And he says, sit in a dark room and do not look at any woman. Go into solitary confinement, he says. What are you going to do in a dark room other than meditate and pray? So do these things for 40 days. And then I just love how he says this, how Rabbi Ishmael says this, so matter-of-factly, as if it was nothing. After I had done this, he taught me a divine name with which I would ascend and descend. So what it says, if you're willing to risk your life and you're willing to go to all of this effort, then you too, and if you have a teacher who can give you the great name to begin with, you can call down the angel Yofiel, the prince of the Torah, and he too will teach you a divine name with which you can ascend and descend. Baruch Hashem. All right. Okay, I'm going to hurry through this third reading because I want to get to the fourth one that talks more about the decline of Merkabah mysticism. Okay, his third reading is also Rabbi Ishmael. Rabbi Akiba related that he asked Rabbi Eliezer the Great, how does one bind the angel of the face, known as Sarma Hapanim, or Sar Hapanim, by an oath so that he should come down to earth and reveal the mysteries of things above and below? He replied to me, my son, I once brought him down, and he wanted to destroy the world. He is a mighty prince, greater than any in the family on high. He constantly stands and serves the king of the universe in cleanliness, abstinence, and purity, in terror and fear for the glory of his master, since the divine presence is with him in every place. Now this is a different angel that Rabbi Akiva is relating, is talking about here. This angel is Sar HaPanim, the angel of the face. Okay, HaPanim, the face of the divine presence, the glory of God. And Rabbi Akiva said, I will oblige him with an oath. Through the knowledge that he will reveal to me, I will oblige him and learn from him. He replied, if one wishes, Rabbi Eliezer replied, if one wishes to oblige himself, he should sit fasting for the entire day when he brings him down. Before that day, he should purify himself for 7 days with the ashes of the red heifer. He should immerse himself in a stream of water and not speak any idle words. At the end of these days of fasting and purification, he should sit in water up to his neck. Before binding the angel with an oath, he should say, I bind you by an oath, princes of pride and terror, who are appointed to strike down one who is not pure and clean, and who dares to reach out to make use of the servants on high. I do this through the glorious and fearsome name. Now, so 2 points I want to bring out here. One is, part of the purification that was required here was to purify himself for 7 days with the ashes of the red heifer. Well, that was fine when those ashes existed. But remember, in 70 AD, Common Era, the temple was destroyed. So whatever ashes existed were it. They couldn't be made again. So they eventually ran out in the 5th century CE. Okay? So that means that one of the main things you had to do, which was purification through the ashes of the red heifer, to enable you to withstand being killed when you ascended on high to the higher levels, you could no longer do. So that's gonna slow down and interfere with and prevent the mystics from ascending to the same high levels that they were able to ascend when they had access to the ashes of the red heifer. Excuse me. And the second thing I want to point out is he's talking here about a formula that's recited to the angel of the face. I bind you by an oath, princes of pride and terror, who are appointed to strike down one who is not pure and clean, and who dares to reach out to make use of the servants on high. I do this through the glorious and fearsome name, ... We're not told what that name is. But there is a name that could bind even the highest of the angels, the angel of the face of God. That's taken from Razo Shel Sandalfon. Okay, now, I've given you an idea through these three readings, which are ancient, very old, more than 1,500, almost 2,000 years, some of them, in age. I've given you an idea of what one had to do to prepare oneself to engage in riding the chariot, in ascending the ladder up into the divine heavens and the seven chambers inside each one of those seven divine heavens. And how one used holy names to bind the gatekeeping angels there so that they, one, wouldn't kill the mystic, and two, so that they would open the gate, the holy gate, so that the mystic could proceed inside the chamber. Okay, now, and I've already told you that in the 5th century, the ashes of the red heifer no longer existed after the 5th century Common Era. So therefore, they could not prepare as they used to do. Now I'm going to read to you some writing here it's a passage from Rabbi Chaim Vital's Shari Kedusha, which means Gates of Holiness. And he lived in the years 1543 to 1620. That's fairly recent. He was a successor to and chief student, the chief scribe, let's put it that way, the chief writer, the chief redactor of the teachings of Isaac Luria, the Arizal, the greatest Kabbalist of all time. And here's what he says about all these things that I've been talking about today. Bear with me, it's a page and a half, but very, very interesting and important. There are four universes: Atzilut, nearness, the universe of the Sephirot, okay, that's all one, Berea, the next lower universe, which means creation, and that's the universe of the throne, Yetzirah, meaning formation, this is the third universe, the universe of the angels, and Asiya, meaning making, and that's the universe of forms. Those are the four universes. Now then, he says, Chaim Vital says, the prophets were able to see into Atzilut, although it was completely clothed in the lights of Berea when they saw it. Ezekiel lived after the destruction of Solomon's temple, and he therefore only received prophecy from Atzilut after it was clothed in Berea, with Berea itself clothed entirely in Yetzirah. Now what he's talking about here is he's talking about seeing through an ispicularia, a lens, looking through a lens. And that's what he means by Ezekiel could only see, Ezekiel could only see into Atzilut after it was clothed. That means layered and through a lens of the universe of Berea, the next universe down, with Berea itself clothed entirely in Yetzirah. So that's through two lenses. Okay? So you're not going to see as clearly. This is the point that's being made here. After this, the lights of Atzilut and Berea were no longer revealed at all. This is the meaning of the teaching that after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, prophecy ended completely, and only Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, remained. This Ruach HaKodesh consists of a transmission of the lights of Yetzirah itself, as well as lower levels. Attaining this level is called ascending to the orchard. I mean, the word is pardes. This refers to Yetzirah, which is called the universe of Metatron, the angel Metatron. Remember Enoch, the great-grandfather of Noah, who we're taught in the Talmud was gathered up by God before he died, and he did not have to die, and he was taken to heaven and transformed into the angel Metatron. Okay. Then he says, there are given techniques through which one can open the gates of the physical world so as to enter Asiya and Yetzirah. Now, the point I want to make about this is he's saying that before, in the old days, before the loss of the Second Temple, the prophets were able to ascend and see into Atzilut and Berea, the two highest of the four universes or four worlds. But after, and this, so this corresponds, see, with the loss of the ashes of the red heifer that we're talking about. So they were no longer able to do that. So the only levels they could attain to would be the two lowest worlds, the world of Yetzirah, that's the world of formation, which is the universe of the angels, and Asiya, the world of making, the universe of action, phenomena, and forms. So right off the bat, without having those ashes, we can only go at the highest to the second level universe, spiritual universe that exists, the second divine heaven, not the fourth. And then he says, these techniques with which one can open the gates of the physical world to enter Asiya and Yetzirah consists of unifications, known in Hebrew as Echunim, which the Arizal originated, and prayers, this is unifications of divine names through meditation, and prayers pertaining to the universe of Yetzirah and its ten sephirot. It is these techniques that are taught in the chapters of the Hekalot. And Hekalot, remember, means the celestial heavens, or the palaces, or the halls, or the chambers. And these practices were used by Rabbi Nehemiah, Rabbi Akiba, Rabbi Ishmael, and the members of the Great Assembly. These techniques were then forgotten. Besides this, the ashes of the red heifer were lost in the period of the later Talmudic sages, the Amorim, during the generation of Abaya and Rava, who lived in the 5th century. So here it's saying what I was telling you about earlier in my teaching, that after the 5th century, there were no longer any ashes of the red heifer remaining to purify oneself. After this, they no longer made use of these techniques to ascend to the orchard. Okay? From then on, people only made use of techniques involving the universe of Asiya. Since this is the lowest of the universes, its angels have only a little good and are mostly evil. Besides this, this is a level where good and evil are closely intertwined, and it is very difficult to separate them. This does not bring any enlightenment, since it is impossible to perceive good alone, and one's perception is therefore a combination of good and evil, truth and falsehood. This is because we're only ascending to the most coarse, most base, lowest level of the divine worlds. We're only ascending into the lowest of those worlds, which is called Asiya. And at that level, most of the angels are evil. That's right, there are evil angels. And I was going to comment on that, but I'm going to let that go, about the difference between the Malakim and the Shadim. But I'll leave that for another teaching. But in any event here, most of the angels, he tells us, at the level of Asiya, are evil. So if we go there and we communicate with any of these angels, which remember, these are just ministering forces. These are ministering aspects of God, ministering powers of God. But they communicate to us in the form of a being. Most of them are going to give us falsehoods instead of truth and do evil toward us and whoever we go back and do work for. When we think that what we're getting is the will of God, we're not. We're getting the will of these evil angels who tell us falsehoods. Okay, so then Kaim Vital goes on to say, this is the significance of the practical Kabbalah. Now, I've had a number of you ask me if I'm going to teach you practical Kabbalah, if I'm going to tell you where you can learn practical Kabbalah. And I've told you, no, I'm not going to, because that is not for us to learn, and it is too dangerous. Now, here's what Rabbi Kaim Vital says. This is the significance of the practical Kabbalah. It is forbidden to make use of it, since evil necessarily attaches itself to the good. One may actually intend to cleanse his soul, but as a result of the evil, he actually defiles it. Even if one does gain some perception, it is truth intermingled with falsehood. This is especially true today, since the ashes of the red heifer no longer exist. The uncleanliness of the husks attaches itself to the individual who attempts to gain enlightenment through practical Kabbalah. This is the uncleanliness of the klipot, the evil husks that reside in the abyss and will pull you down and trap you. Therefore, quote, he who watches his soul should keep far from them, end quote. And he says, he's citing another teaching. For besides polluting his soul, he will also be punished in purgatory, which is Gehenna. We also have a tradition that such an individual will be punished in this world. Either he or his children will become sick, will be impoverished, or will become apostates. That means convert to some other religion, abandon the faith. Learn a lesson from Joseph de la Reina and Rabbi Shlomo Molko, who made use of the practical Kabbalah and was destroyed from the world. And this is a great warning here. And he says, all this is because of the above-mentioned reason. This involves a realm where there is no good devoid of evil. Besides this, it involves coercing angels with oaths against their will. These angels retaliate by enticing this individual, drawing him into evil ways until his soul is destroyed. Beyond this, the methods involving these oaths were concealed by earlier generations, and we are not well versed in the proper techniques. One must therefore keep himself far from these things. So says Rabbi Kaim Vital in section 3, part 6 of the Gates of Holiness, Shaarei Kedusha. So there's all kinds of reasons why, after the 5th century, the practice of Merkabah mysticism, in which one transcended this body and this world and ascended into the upper worlds, the higher universes, the divine worlds, and was confronted by guardian angels that had the power to destroy one, and then recited divine names and bound them with oaths after reciting those names, getting them in their power with the names, and binding them with oaths against their will, one progressed on. And so, no longer having the ashes of the red heifer to purify ourselves, it meant that we were going to be repulsed by the holy angels and attracted to, and have attracted to us, the angels of evil and the evil shells that were cast into the abyss with the destruction of the worlds. So nothing good could come out of it. Truth would be mixed with lies, and so the revelations could not be trusted. And you could, your actual soul could be bound by the taken into captivity, actually drawn inside and imprisoned in the evil husks, the evil shells, and carried off down into the abyss, where one would have to wait to be liberated for who knows how long by the Shekinah, and or destroyed entirely by one of these wrathful angels. All right. That concludes today's teachings. And today's teaching will be rebroadcast tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday, we will actually begin to talk about early Kabbalah. And this does, in fact, conclude my teachings at this time on Merkabah mysticism. I'm surprised, really, how long those teachings went on. But that's the nature of the Ruach HaKodesh, which is all that's left to us now that we no longer have the ashes of the red heifer and the secrets that have been forgotten of the early sages that were just described by Rabbi Chaim Vital. All right. Until we meet again, don't forget to remember God at least twice a day, and may you go from strength to strength and be well. Sei gesund.